Imam, the ninth divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Now, dear friends, of course, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam has spoken about a great many things. Of course, all of the Imams have talked about a great many things. But we find, interestingly, that all of the Imams have a tendency to focus quite a bit on moral and ethical matters, which in Arabic we call akhlaq. Now, this akhlaq, which is normally translated as morals and ethics, the kind of proper and virtuous behaviors that a person should have. In reality, it is this akhlaq and these virtues that one should have that really perfect a human being. Of course, along with other matters of knowledge and wisdom, whether it is the religious laws, which also are very important for every single one of us to know, especially those daily ahkam and those daily rules and regulations that every single one of us should know in order to be able to answer our questions and our doubts and to be able to correctly follow the religion of Islam. Of course, another one is this aqa'id or the theology or the belief systems that are in Islam. Normally, we have a tendency to talk about the usuluddin and the furu'uddin, the usul or the main principles of the religion, you know, tawheed, adalat, nabuwat, imamat, qiyamat, these kind of things. Of course, we should believe in them. So these are the two things. And the third one is this akhlaqi and these virtues and how to be, you know, a complete human being. It's really kind of a practical aspect of these things, of this spiritual wayfaring, excuse me, on the path of Allah. And so here, when it comes to akhlaq, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam has a conversation with his companions. And one of his companions asks him about good morals and specifically asks him about sincerity, ikhlas. Now, what's interesting is that ikhlas itself is, as we said, commonly defined as sincerity. But of course, it has a much more profound meaning, and you would need a much longer episode in order to speak about the various aspects of ikhlas and of sincerity. But here, I want to bring in this this part of the conversation that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam had, where he says that sincerity is one's forbidding others from that which one does not like. Now, of course, a lot of times, you know, the statements of the Imams, of course, because they are in Arabic, there is a much more profound meaning in the original Arabic. When it's translated, it has a very almost stationary and a very rigid explanation, when in reality there's much more flexibility, much more depth, much more wisdom in these statements of the divinely appointed Imams. So now here you might think that, okay, so sincerity, ikhlas, is to forbid another person from that which I don't like. Now here, this I don't like is something that I would like to focus on. So for example, on one hand, we could say, I don't personally like the color red. Or I don't personally like bananas. Or I don't personally like the cultural clothing, for example, of, I don't know, Iranians, for example. Now, if you had noticed, every single place I said that I personally do not like. Now here the divinely appointed Imam, who is talking about good morals and good ethics, and who is talking about ikhlas and sincerity, and when you put all the other traditions along with this tradition, you realize that that which I do not like is that which I do not like, which is within the framework and within the, within the framework of the religion of Islam. So, for example, I do not like lying because Islam does not like lying. I do not like, shamefulness and immodesty because Islam does not like shamefulness and immodesty. Or, for example, I do not like cheating and lying and wearing inappropriate clothes because Islam does not like cheating and does not like lying and does not like immodest clothing. Now, here we have defined that which I do not like. Now, that which I do not like, which is in correspondence with what Islam teaches, is what I should be forbidding others from if I am sincere. Make sense? And put it the other way around. So I'm a sincere person. That means I'm honest in what I'm trying to do. I'm honest with the other person. I am sincere with the other person. I don't have any ulterior motives with the other person. I really do care about the other person. Now, when you really do care about another person, of course, you will encourage them to do good, to do things that please you within the framework of the religion. And on the other hand, you will forbid others from those things which displease you, of course, within the framework of the religion. Otherwise, this conversation would not make sense, as I had previously spoken about the example if we took this as being a personal dislike. It is not a personal dislike, it is a religious dislike. And of course, if we were to do this to help one another in our society, in our homes, in our communities, you know, in our neighborhoods, to forbid them from doing those things which are displeasing to Almighty Allah and are specifically portrayed and announced in the religion, then of course we would live in a much safer, a much more beautiful, a much more pious environment that would be of benefit to every single one of us. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The United States House of Representatives has announced an investigation into allegations of a secret deal to boost oil production between the administration of President Joe Biden and Saudi Arabia. Biden is accused of trying to arrange a deal with Riyadh to increase oil production ahead of the U.S. midterm elections last month. Conservative lawmakers say that could represent election manipulation. It's the first official probe announced since the Republicans won control of the House of Representatives. Many other controversial hearings are expected to follow, such as on the handling of the coronavirus, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, corruption allegations involving Biden's son, and others. Just as Democrats forced questionable investigations over the past 2 years, a now divided Congress will likely be preoccupied with partisan issues of often questionable importance to the average person.
in the end of neoliberalism, we're in a kind of age of disorder. And this is kind of the show that is being played out, is that people are just going to be disillusioned from politics entirely. And that's going to open up the potential of polarization, like wider polarization.
Pro-Trump representatives in the House have already introduced articles of impeachment against Biden over the family-related corruption allegations. Many are skeptical that Congress will devote enough time to meeting the widespread economic problems caused by record inflation and Western belligerence towards Russia, China, Iran, and others.
Now, let's still push through the agenda that's necessary to to maintain the super rich are super rich, and that no relief for the working class. And once again, points to the need for the urgency for the foundation for a new party and also ultimately a new system.
An irony is that Riyadh and the OPEC Plus oil production group ultimately ignored Biden's demands for more oil and instead voted to cut production. And despite the cuts, last month Biden still awarded Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman immunity for all cases involving the infamous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Biden campaigned on holding bin Salman accountable, and his backtracking drew global condemnation. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
More than 1 year after the Taliban returned to power, a Gallup survey has found that almost all Afghans, or 98%, rate their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. The survey shows that the situation is getting worse for Afghans, and they have fully lost hope that their future will be any better.
Absolutely, people are suffering, especially from joblessness, poverty, insecurity, and little access to their basic rights. Their life conditions were grim even before the Taliban takeover, but recently people's hardships have become even worse. Still, we are not sure what the future holds for us.
Currently, Afghan girls and women are dealing with many difficulties, especially their struggle to get education or a job to make ends meet. Poverty has not only affected men, but also the well-being of Afghan women and children. Being relatively barred from public places makes us further desperate.
According to the survey, 9 in 10 Afghans say they find it very difficult to make ends meet. 92% of the respondents say they think it is a bad time to find a job, while 86% say they have been unable to buy themselves food.
Making ends meet has become very difficult. We need to skip some meals to survive. The arrival of the cold season is adding to the people's suffering. With no job and relief assistance, you can imagine how disastrous people's lives can become.
I'm the sole breadwinner of my 8-member family. Sometimes I can put food on the table, but sometimes we go to bed hungry. The situation is so difficult that sometimes we can't even buy ourselves some oil. Having heating or other necessities is becoming almost impossible.
The Gallup survey also reveals that the unpopularity of the American leadership has risen to a record 84% among Afghans. Meanwhile, the poll shows more and more Afghans are looking favorably towards Iran, as the neighboring country's popularity is on the rise. Afghanistan is rated as the most suffering and unhappiest country in the world. Many here believe the current situation is a direct result of the U.S. occupation and war in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Planned nationwide strikes were supposed to start on Monday across Iran, based on social media posts that have been calling for business owners to roll down their shutters for 3 days. A quick stroll on the streets of Tehran, however, shows that all the fuss is limited to the virtual world.
Life goes on as normal here in this district. I think social media exaggerates the problems. From what I saw today, no one is paying attention to the calls for a strike.
The country has been gripped by street violence for 10 weeks now, with anti-government protests claiming the lives of civilians and security forces. Now the same protesters have called for a three-day strike, marking the anniversary of the National Student Day in the country.
Student Day belongs to the Islamic Revolution and is a manifestation of the repression exercised by the former Pahlavi regime against our people. So it can't be used to protest against the Islamic establishment. I'm certain that all of the plots hatched to cause trouble to our country are doomed to failure.
Videos circulating on social media show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed. However, people say some shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism by protesters.
Everyone is busy with their businesses today. There are some shops which have been closed, but the majority of them fear possible damage by protesters.
The Islamic Republic says what's happening on social media is not a true reflection of what's actually going on the ground. Over the past days, Iranian officials have been calling for a national dialogue to, quote, stop the enemy from fishing in troubled waters. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Russian prisoners of war being executed by Ukrainian soldiers. Multiple videos have been released on Ukrainian Telegram channels. The most recent shows 11 Russian soldiers shot in the head after being detained. While both sides accuse each other of war crimes, Kiev is openly flaunting the crimes committed at the hands of its troops. At a press conference in Lugansk, a Russian soldier, Dmitry, recounts what happened when he was captured on the front line.
They ordered me to lie down, hands behind my back. One of them came up to me and hit my back with the handle of his machine gun. They put a bag on my head and waited for their commanders. In some time, the commander came, took the bag off my head, took me by the throat and started to cut my left hand with a knife. It's still functioning badly. He hit me in the teeth. And afterwards, when they took my machine gun from the vehicle, he asked if it was charged. I answered that it wasn't. He took the cartridge from it, clicked it, pointed at my leg and clicked. Nothing happened, because it was really not charged. He said I was lucky.
On the screen, gruesome images. Russian authorities say they have evidence of torture and a lack of provision of basic medical care, leading to unnecessary death.
Now, many of these atrocities are being ignored by media outlets in NATO countries, but Russian journalists, of course, are here transmitting to a Russian audience, which means large parts of the Russian population are becoming increasingly angry at Ukraine and its NATO backers for atrocities committed against Russian soldiers.
The videos that show Russian prisoners of war being essentially murdered after they've surrendered have been posted by Ukrainian soldiers. These are videos taken by Ukrainian soldiers and then posted on the internet, essentially as a point of pride, in the belief that they are somehow another frightening or horrifying the Russians, who knows. But I also think there's another sinister dimension to this. I think there's an interest in Ukraine, particularly in Kiev or Kyiv, to ensure that there can be no negotiated settlement between Ukraine and Russia, not so much because of people in Kiev that might be willing to talk, but I think there's growing fear that Washington will ultimately abandon them.
As Russia continues to destroy energy infrastructure and kill Ukrainian soldiers on the front lines in Donbass, and as Ukraine continues to shell civilians in Donetsk and release videos of its war crimes, anger is reaching new heights on both sides, making peace an even more distant prospect. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on the impact of the continued Saudi siege on thalassemia patients. Those suffering from this disease need to get blood transfusions every 3 weeks and must stay on medication for life.
Our main concern is the lack of medicines for thalassemia patients. These medicines, if available, are very expensive. In addition to the lack of necessary medical examinations, we have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni health ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdulatif Lwashali, Sana'a.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including Centre-Left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
Pakistan has hosted a dialogue platform for the OIC member states to boost cooperation among them in the field of science and technology. Senior officials representing Iran, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Pakistan attended the meeting, while Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Arab Emirates, and Cameroon participated via video conference. The first senior officials meeting of the OIC Forum was aimed at strengthening scientific cooperation and to encouraging major technological initiatives.
This forum provides us opportunities of bilateral, multilateral cooperation. So one or two or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical, and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister, Peyman Salehi, told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in near future. Therefore, we arrange for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals, and at the moment we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology parks in Iran, more than 240 incubators, and so on.
Participants in the meeting discussed in detail the objectives, terms of reference, and working procedures of the OIC 15 and recommended them for adoption by the ministerial committee, which is scheduled to be held in the near future.
The presence of Iranian officials in the OIC meeting shows that Iran is not dependent on the East or the West, and it's ready to boost its political and scientific cooperation with various countries across the globe. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
South Korea's container and cement truck drivers are out in the cold, on strike with no extension to an agreement they say ensures safe cargo transportation and livable incomes. The union also wants tanker trucks, auto carriers, and delivery vehicles included in their deal. The strike action has widened to Seoul Metro Subway, with other transportation workers also threatening walkouts.
Believing in the government's commitment to the constitution and expansion of the safe freight system, we held off the strike and waited. But the system expires in a month, and the government's promise has not been kept. So we had no choice but to bring out our last card, the strike card.
Slowdown in construction and cargo delivery has already caused hundreds of millions in damages each day, with 5,000 truckers off the job. The slowdowns are rippling through South Korea's export-led economy as the strike enters its second week. President Yoon Suk-yeol this week ordered cement truck drivers back to work, with construction companies reporting losses into the tens of millions of dollars.
The foundation of our industries is in danger of being devastated. Even people's daily lives are being threatened. There is no way to justify the act of taking the lives of people and the national economy hostage to accomplish their own interest.
The Yoon administration has vowed to deal sternly with the illegal strike action.
The truckers were on strike just 5 months ago, but that strike only ended with the extension of the safe trucking freight rate system through the end of this year. With the government's back-to-work order, the truckers are threatened with fines and even jail sentences for those refusing to get back behind the wheel. Frank Smith, WeWang, South Korea.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has repeated his allegations about fraud in the 2020 presidential election and called for suspension of America's Constitution. The Biden White House has strongly criticized Donald Trump for calling for the termination of the Constitution. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. CNN has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump has called for the termination of the U.S. Constitution's rules regarding elections to overturn the results of the disputed 2020 presidential election, following the emergence of evidence that social media sided with the Washington establishment to suppress negative reports about Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, ahead of the election. Donald Trump said on Saturday, 3rd of December, the founding fathers of the United States did not want fraudulent elections in the country. Elon Musk released what he called the Twitter files on Friday, 2nd of December, delving into the company's decision to block the Hunter Biden laptop story. The post focused on the controversy surrounding Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and Twitter's reaction limiting the spread of posts about it. It was billed as a bombshell that exposed how Twitter engaged in free speech suppression in the critical run-up to the 2020 presidential election. Trump said in a Truth Social post, "A massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. Our great founders did not want and would not condone false and fraudulent elections." Donald Trump said the revelations show massive and widespread fraud and deception from Big Tech, the Democratic National Committee, and the Democratic Party, asking if the 2020 presidential election results should be thrown out and he should be declared the winner, or if a new election should be held. Trump believes that the election was rigged by the U.S. establishment in favor of Joe Biden. He has said that the 2020 presidential election was the greatest election hoax in history. He previously accused Twitter and Facebook of helping Joe Biden to win the election. Pulitzer Prize-winning American investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald has revealed that an axis of the CIA, big technology firms, and the Democratic National Committee, allied wing of the corporate media, spread an absolute lie in the weeks before the 2020 presidential election to help Joe Biden win the vote. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. The Biden White House rebuked Donald Trump after the former president said the U.S. Constitution should be terminated over his claim that the 2020 election was stolen. Andrew Bates, a White House spokesperson, said attacking the Constitution and all it stands for is anathema to the soul of our nation and should be universally condemned. Andrew Bates called the Constitution a sacrosanct document saying you cannot only love America when you win. Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden in 2020 by more than 7 million votes and by 306 to 232 in the Electoral College count, a result he called a landslide when it was in his favor in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump continues to say that Joe Biden won key states through electoral fraud, a claim that fueled the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6 of January 2021. 9 deaths have been linked to the riot in the Capitol building, including law enforcement suicides. More than 950 people have been charged. Recently, 2 members of the far-right Oath Keepers militia were convicted of seditious conspiracy. Other members of far-right, pro-Trump groups face similar charges. Donald Trump was banned from Facebook and Twitter after the Capitol attack. He has not yet returned to the latter, despite his new owner, Elon Musk, saying he's free to do so. Donald Trump is the only declared candidate for a Republican nomination in 2024, but he has faced increasing criticism from within the Republican ranks. And Republicans supporting media since midterm elections in which many of his endorsed candidates were defeated, including election deniers in battleground states. Republicans took the House of Representatives, but only by a narrow margin, and failed to retake the U.S. Senate. On Saturday, 3rd of December, Donald Trump also criticized the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and all of the weak Republicans who couldn't get the presidential election of 2020 approved and out of the way fast enough. Even after the Capitol riot, 147 Republicans objected to results in key states. Senior Republicans have also criticized Donald Trump over his decision to have dinner at his home in Florida with Nick Fuentes, a known white supremacist and anti-Semite. The website Politico has also covered the same story. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, called former President Donald Trump an enemy of the Constitution on Sunday, 4th of December, after Trump suggested considering terminating the Constitution on Saturday, 3rd of December, the most overt condemnation in the GOP of Donald Trump's words. Liz Cheney tweeted, "No honest person can now deny that Trump is an enemy of the Constitution." Other Republicans joined Cheney in being critical of the idea of the Constitution being set aside, but they declined to say whether they'd vote for Donald Trump again after their statement. Representative Mike Turner, a Republican from Ohio, said, "It is certainly not consistent with the oath that we all take. I vehemently disagree with the statement from Donald Trump that Donald Trump has made." But Turner, speaking to host Margaret Brennan on CBS's Face the Nation program, declined to say Donald Trump's remarks were disqualifying when it came to his presidential candidacy. Turner said, "There is a political process that has to go forward." On Saturday, 3rd of December, Brian Schatz, a Democratic U.S. senator from Hawaii, pointed to such hard political reality, saying, "Trump just called for the suspension of the Constitution, and this is the final straw for zero Republicans, especially the ones who call themselves constitutional conservatives. One such conservative is Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader battling to become House Speaker. Not long before Donald Trump said the Constitution should be terminated, Kevin McCarthy said that when his party took control in January, it would demonstrate its constitutional bona fides by reading every single word of the hallowed document on the floor of the House. On Sunday, 4th of December, Hakeem Jeffries, the newly elected Democratic leader in the House, told ABC's This Week program Trump had made a strange statement, but the Republicans are going to have to work out their issues with the former president and decide whether they're going to break from him and return to some semblance of reasonableness or continue to lean in to extremism, not just of Donald Trump, but of Trumpism. On the same show, Dave Joyce of Ohio, chair of the Moderate Republican Governance Group, refused five opportunities to say he would not vote for Donald Trump if he was the nominee in 2024. John Bolton, George W. Bush's United Nations ambassador who became Donald Trump's third national security advisor, said, "No American conservative can agree with Donald Trump's call to suspend the Constitution because the results of the 2020 election. And all real conservatives must oppose his 2024 campaign for president."
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, scholars, and ulama. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi Sheikh Ziyani. Sheikh Ziyani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum to you.
Walaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about Muhammad Saleh Ha'iri Mazandarani, mainly known as Allame Semnani, one of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite philosophers, fuqaha, and mutakallimin and mufassirin of the 14th century Hijra, who was mainly expert in the field of Mashah philosophy of Islamic philosophy. Sheikh Ziyani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Allame Semnani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Saleh Ha'iri Mazandarani, mainly known as Allame Semnani, was born in 1297 according to Hijri lunar calendar, and he was born in Karbala. When he was studying his primary studies in Karbala, I mean Arabic grammar and literature, he had a meeting with the famous scholar of that time, famous marja, Mahum Akhund Khorasani, rahmatullah alayhi, may God bless his soul. And late Akhund Khorasani understood that this boy, this young man, has a good talent in Islamic studies. So that's why he invited Muhammad Saleh Ha'iri Mazandarani to Najaf to participate in the course of Kharij of Usul and Fiqh in Najaf. And Marhum Muhammad Saleh Mazandarani left Karbala to Najaf with Akhund Khorasani rahmatullah alayh. And he got one of the most important students of Akhund Khorasani, so that when Akhund al-Khorasani wanted to compile his book Kifayatul Usul Marhum Muhammad Saleh Mazandarani was one of the most important assistants of him in this project.
Oh, really?
He also participated in intellectual studies, I mean philosophy and hikmah. And he was a student of Mullah Ismail Burujerdi Ha'iri in this field. And even he studied mathematics. He continued his studies in Najaf for 12 years. And he received the permission of Ijtihad and also the permission of Rivayat. And left Najaf and came back to Iran because he was originally Iranian, although he was born in Najaf in Karbala in Iraq, but he was originally Iranian. So that's why he returned back to Iran, to his motherland, to preach the Islamic concepts for people.
That's right.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل
And so he was known as Ha'iri Mazandarani, but he was known as Allame Semnani.
There's a story behind it.
What's the story?
The story behind calling him Allame Semnani is because of his landmark speech against Reza Khan. Because by the moment he entered Iran, it was the time that Reza Khan had put ban over the Majalis Adha. The Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. At that time, even though Reza Khan, the moment he wanted to take the power in his hand, pretending or participating in the Aza Majalis and putting mud on his face to show himself as a religious personality, after a while when his kingdom became stable, he started to expose his real face to all of the people. So we see that two very important things that he issued was one hijab ban and the other ban over the Majalis Aza, to the extent that people were not allowed to hold Majalis Aza in private in their houses.
That's
so
right.
At that moment, Allame Semnani, by that time, he was still Muhammad Saleh Ha'iri Mazandarani, couldn't tolerate this behavior from Reza Khan. So he went up the member in Babul, his city, hometown for his generation,
yes,
because he was born in Karbala.
Yes.
His ancestors were born there.
Okay.
So he went up the member, and one sentence, which is very famous, has been narrated from him. He said, whoever opposes Quran is regarded kafir, no matter what, even though he is Reza Khan.
Mm-hmm.
So even he stipulated the name Reza Khan as a kafir in his member. Immediately after this speech, they arrested him and imprisoned, and Reza Khan himself issued the verdict for executing this great alim. But because of the opposition of most of the great ulama and mujtahideen who couldn't apply to this or accomplish his wish, that's why he was forced to put him in exile. And what was the city to which he was sent? It was Semnan. That's why he stayed there till the end of till the end of the time of Reza Khan.
That's right.
And when Reza Khan left Iran because of the coup that happened, and his son came over and took the power in his hand. Allama Semnani wanted to leave Semnan, but this time people of Semnan didn't let him go, saying that now you are among us, you belong to us, you have to stay among us, you taught us everything. So you see this popular face of the ulama, whenever they go, they preach Islam, with their behavior they can bring up children, people, generation after generation to the moment that people to whom he does not belong at the beginning wouldn't let him out, saying that you have to stay among us. And he is more famous by the name Allama Semnani rather than Allama Ha'iri Mazandarani.
That's all right, very nice. So it shows that politically and socially he was active too. That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Philosophically speaking, you know, in contrary to most of the scholars of his time, he believed in esalat mahiyat, in contradiction to esalat wujud.
Okay, as you know, the mainstream in amongst the philosophers in last two centuries, most of them, they do believe in the school of thought of Hikmatul Muta'aliyah, and they believe in the esalatul wujud, or the originality of existence. But Marhum Allama Semnani was believing in the originality of essence. That is another idea here. Of course, some philosophers like Ibn Sina and some others were believing in this idea that the originality is in essence, not in existence. But after Mullah Sadra, many scholars, they accepted the idea of Mullah Sadra, rahmatullah alayh. But Marhum Allama Semnani rejected again the idea of Mullah Sadra and accepted the idea of Ibn Sina, that is the originality is in essence. Another aspect of his life is that besides being a philosopher, he was also a poet.
Yes.
And he had a good relationship with some poems of his time, like Nima Yushiji, that is a really famous, that is really a famous poet at the, you know, last century in Iran. And it is really interesting that the scholar that is the source of knowledge for people.
That's right.
And is preaching Islam for them in a city that he is not belonging to. But people are accepting him in a way that they do not let him go after some years. But beside this, he is really an expert in philosophy, and another aspect of him is to be a poet. So he was really a polymath, and he deserved this title.
That's all right. As you said, he had good relation with the most outstanding poems of his time, like Jalaluddin Humayi and Ali Esfandiari, mainly known as Nima Yushich. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, anything missed about Allama Semnani?
Just regarding what my brother mentioned to be a polymath, you just look at his works, as my brother said at the beginning, when he was really, really young scholar, his work was acknowledged by the great scholar Akhund Khorasani to the level that he took him with him to Najaf. So he had a lot of works regarding fiqh usul, and then when it comes to philosophy, you see his works regarding the philosophy mainly regarding the treaties and concepts mentioned in Hikmat Masha. We see the works Al-Yad al-Bayda, Risalatun fi Hal al-Nazm, Risalatun fi Hal al-Nazm Mantiq al-Sabzawari, Risalat al-Wadai al-Hikam. All of these works are the philosophical works. And this is not only, his works are not limited to the field of study of philosophy and fiqh usul. We see in tafsir and in miscellaneous fields of study, he has some works. So it shows his mastery over different fields of studies. So all of this make us to acknowledge his personality and his position and his contribution to our Shia legacy. May Allah bless him.
1350 according to the solar calendar, 1391 according to the lunar calendar, this outstanding man passed away, that is Muhammad Saleh Hariri Mazandarani, known as Allama Semnani. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Imam Reza alayhi salam in the holy city of Mashhad, and he is buried over there. May Allah bless the soul of Allama Semnani, one of the most outstanding philosophers of the 14th century Hijra. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
A teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.